Picture this. You're driving through Los Angeles on just like a perfect sunny afternoon.
Oh yeah, best feeling.
Right. And you're cruising past these beautiful, sprawling, historic estates, like in Bel Air or something. You catch these little glimpses of iconic Hollywood architecture tucked behind those massive manicured hedges.
The ones you can barely see from the street.
Exactly. And, it really feels like you're moving through a city that is actively successfully preserving its soul. You see these homes and think, well, it's great that someone is protecting that history for all of us.
Yeah, on the surface, it looks like a total win for the public.
Right. But what if that preservation is actually like a perfectly legal, practically invisible wealth transfer
I
system?
mean, that's the real question here.
Yeah. What if the mechanics keeping that private estate looking pristine are quietly costing the public millions of dollars every single year?
It's honestly a pretty jarring juxtaposition when you look into it.
Yeah.
Because, we universally think of historical preservation as a civic good.
Of course we do.
But then, below the surface, you have this economic engine basically running in reverse, channeling public funds right into private equity.
Which brings us to today's deep dive. Welcome, everyone. Today we are looking at a really rigorous policy analysis report. It's titled The Cost of Preservation: Reforming LA's Historic Cultural Monument Program.
It's a fascinating read.
It really is. And our mission today is to unpack how a City Program 1 that was specifically designed to protect history and boost tourism actually operates in practice. Because, spoiler alert, it functions as a massive tax reduction vehicle for high-value real estate.
Yeah, and we're also going to explore the structural reforms this report proposes to, untangle the whole mess.
Right. But before we get into the weeds, we should probably set the tone right up front for you listening.
Yes, definitely. The goal of our conversation today, and honestly the goal of this report, is absolutely not to attack the concept of historic preservation.
No, not at all.
Preserving culturally significant architecture is a totally valid public interest. I mean, we both agree on that.
100%.
Our aim in this deep dive is just to examine the hidden machinery of the city policy itself. We need to look closely at who really wins, who absorbs the hidden costs, and how we might rethink the underlying economics of urban history.
Because, as we'll see, the data suggests the system is currently doing the exact opposite of what it claims to do. So let's start with the primary justification for giving these property owners a tax break. It's almost always the same excuse. Tourism.
Right, tourism.
Yeah.
The prevailing idea is that preserving these buildings supports cultural vitality, draws tourists, and boosts the local economy.
Which sounds perfectly logical on paper. I mean, tourists like nice old buildings.
It does. But then you start looking at the actual data the researchers pulled for this report, and the reality fractures pretty
Oh, it
quickly.
completely falls apart.
Yeah. The contrast is incredibly stark. The researchers decided to map out every single historic cultural monument, or HCM, within the Hollywood Community Plan area.
And Hollywood is arguably the most tourist-dense district in all of Los Angeles.
Exactly. The logic being, if the tourism argument holds up anywhere, it has to hold up in Hollywood.
Right. So, how many monuments are we actually talking about in that specific zone?
Well, there are 536 of these historic cultural monuments in that Hollywood zone alone.
Wow, 536.
Yeah. But out of those 536, the report found that 454 of them are completely, quote unquote, peripheral.
Meaning they have zero meaningful tourist exposure, right?
Zero. They're tucked away on private streets, hidden behind giant gates, or, perched on residential hillsides where no tourist is ever going to wander by and see them.
So the vast majority are literally invisible to the public. What about the rest of them?
So, of the remaining buildings, 59 are considered neutral, meaning they are physically located in the tourist zone, maybe on a main street, but they don't actively contribute to or detract from the cultural draw.
Just kind of there.
Right. And then four of them are actually actively detracting.
Wait, really? Detracting.
Yeah, these are vacant or failing buildings where the historic designation is just legally locking in the deterioration. Basically, the owner can't or won't fix it to historic standards, so it just rots.
Oh, wow. Which leaves us with a shockingly low number. Five. Exactly five buildings out of 536 that actively contribute to the tourism draw in a measurable way.
Just five.
That is wild. And when the researchers looked citywide, it's just as bad. They found that 84.6% of all these subsidized buildings offer absolutely no clear public benefit, no public access, no active cultural use, nothing.
Nothing at all.
I mean, if the city is essentially paying for a billboard that no one can see, why do we keep writing the check? Isn't this just a massive oversight by the zoning department?
You'd think so, but no, it's not an oversight at all. It's actually a structural feature of the policy itself. The core problem with the tourism argument is that it is structurally unfalsifiable.
Unfalsifiable meaning what exactly in this context? That the city just, like, never bothers to check the receipts?
Essentially, yeah. In science or logic, if a claim is unfalsifiable, it means there is no way to test it or prove it wrong.
Oh, I see.
Right, so at the exact moment a building is designated as historic, the city can claim that it might contribute to cultural vitality. But the policy never requires anyone to actually measure whether it does 5 or 10 or 20 years down the line.
So the subsidy just continues indefinitely.
Exactly. And the deepest irony here is that the buildings that genuinely drive Hollywood tourism places, like the Chinese Theater or the Dolby Theater.
Right, the really famous ones.
Yeah, those are preserved through entirely different institutional and commercial mechanisms. They don't even depend on this specific tax break, which is called the Mills Act.
Because they'd exist and be maintained purely because of their commercial value anyway.
Exactly.
That basically implies the buildings that actually drive tourism don't need this specific subsidy, and the hundreds of buildings getting the subsidy don't drive tourism.
You're hitting the nail on the head. The data shows 221 buildings where the Mills Act tax break is the only stated economic rationale for the preservation.
That's crazy.
It is. The policy claims a public benefit at the start, but never follows up to ensure the public is actually benefiting.
Okay, so if the tourism angle is a total bust, why does this loophole survive? Like, how does a program that fails its primary objective stay on the books for decades?
To understand that, the researchers actually utilized game theory.
Wait, game theory? Like the prisoner's dilemma?
Exactly like that. They frame this entire civic ecosystem as a game with four specific players sitting at a table. The current situation isn't the result of corruption or, like, a mistake.
So what is it?
It is the highly predictable result of each player rationally pursuing their own best interest. Economists call this a Nash equilibrium.
Okay, let's break down these four players, because once you see the board, the mechanics make total sense.
Yeah, let's go through them.
Player one is the city council. Now, what is their motivation? I mean, they want re-election, they want the positive optics of being pro-preservation, and they want zero political friction.
Right. So their move in the game is to offer this tax break to property owners in exchange for what's called a maintenance covenant.
Which is what, exactly?
Essentially a legally binding promise attached to the property deed where the owner agrees to keep the building looking historically accurate.
Oh, okay. So the city council gets to issue a press release claiming a huge win for cultural tourism. They get campaign support from the preservation lobby, and the actual financial cost is just hidden.
Completely hidden. It's so spread out among the general public that no single taxpayer ever notices. For the politicians, it's a highly visible win with totally invisible costs.
Wow. Then you have player two. The wealthy property owner. Their motivation is simple, right? They want lower property taxes on a luxury home they were realistically going to maintain anyway. Their move is just to hire a specialist, file the designation paperwork, sign that maintenance covenant, and renew it forever. And the payoff is massive.
Well, it's huge. We're talking $5,000 to $25,000 or more in tax savings every single year in perpetuity.
Which brings us to player three. And honestly, this is the most fascinating piece of the puzzle to me. The preservation specialists.
Oh, yeah. These are the lawyers, the architectural consultants, the compliance firms. They act as the gatekeepers to the subsidy.
The people who actually navigate the massive bureaucracy for the wealthy owner.
Exactly. And what they want is a steady stream of billable hours. A complex bureaucratic program that a regular person cannot possibly navigate without hiring a specialist is literally the perfect product for them.
Right.
So their move is to market this service to wealthy homeowners, handle all the dense historical filings, and crucially, lobby the city against ever simplifying the program.
Because, I mean, if the application is simple, you don't need to pay a consultant $10,000 to $20,000 upfront to handle it for you, plus a couple of $1,000s a year in maintenance fees.
Precisely. The report estimates this specific specialist class extracts $32.2 million in professional fees over the lifetime of a cohort.
Wow, $32 million.
Yeah. They don't just benefit from the red tape, they actively engineer it. They act as a ratchet, ensuring the system stays convoluted so their services remain essential.
That is wild. Which brings us to player four, the diffuse taxpayer. That is you listening to this right now.
Yo.
What does the taxpayer want? Good public services, well-paved roads, and a fair tax system. But the taxpayer's move in this game is simply to do nothing.
But why? I mean, the report notes a $505 million compounded public cost over 30 years in foregone property tax revenue.
That's $500 million. That should have gone to LA's schools, parks, and road repairs. If the public is losing $500 million, why aren't people rioting outside City Hall?
It really comes down to a concept developed by the economist Mankur Olson back in 1965. It's about the threshold for rational political action.
Okay, unpack that for us.
He described the pattern of concentrated benefits versus diffuse costs. For the wealthy property owner, the benefit is highly concentrated. They are personally saving tens of thousands of dollars a year.
Which is a massive, immediate incentive to organize, hire lobbyists, and aggressively defend the program.
Exactly. But for the diffuse taxpayer, that $505 million loss is spread out over millions of people. Your individual, direct cost for this program might only be $2 or $3 a year.
It's like when your streaming service quietly raises its price by like 50 cents a month. The CEO of that company makes millions off the hike, but you aren't going to cancel your subscription or march in the streets over 50 cents.
Exactly. You just grumble and pay it because the cost of fighting it isn't worth your time.
That is the exact mechanism. The cost of educating yourself about the intricacies of the Historic Cultural Monument Program, organizing a political movement, and lobbying the city council far exceeds the $2 you would personally save by dismantling it.
Right. So it is entirely rational for you to ignore it.
That perfectly describes the Nash equilibrium. Every player is playing their best strategy given what everyone else is doing. The council gets an easy win.
Yep.
The owner gets a huge tax break. The specialist gets their fees. And the taxpayer doesn't care enough to stop it. No one can improve their outcome by changing their strategy, creating a perfectly stable trap.
It is a stable trap, but a profoundly socially inefficient one. While the direct cost to you is only a few dollars, the indirect cost is massive.
Right, because of where that money isn't going.
Exactly. The $505 million in foregone revenue means real cuts to public services. And the tragedy is that the burden of those cuts falls entirely on the people who have no choice but to rely on public schools and public transit.
While the person getting the massive tax subsidy can afford private school, private security, and private country clubs.
Exactly. The person absorbing the cost of the underfunded public school cannot opt out.
So the subsidy basically seeks out the wealthy, and the cost falls on the vulnerable. But we need to look even deeper, because as the researchers dive into the financial data, we realize this Mills Act tax break isn't even the first tax break these owners are getting.
Oh, not even close.
We have to talk about how this interacts with California's already bizarre property tax laws.
This is a uniquely Californian phenomenon, and it completely supercharges the wealth transfer we're talking about. Back in 1978, California passed Proposition 13.
Prop 13.
Yeah. Prop 13 fundamentally altered property taxes by freezing a property's assessed value at its original purchase price. And it capped annual growth at a maximum of just 2%, regardless of what the real estate market does.
Let's make sure we explain how wild that mechanism is for anyone outside of California. If you bought a house in Los Angeles in, say, 1995 for $300,000, and today that house is worth $3 million on the open market.
You are not paying taxes on $3 million.
Right. Prop 13 means you are paying property taxes based on a slightly adjusted version of that 1995 price.
Which is incredible. For owners who have held their properties for decades in a market that appreciates as rapidly as Los Angeles, the Prop 13 discount alone is already enormous. Their assessed value is a fraction of the actual market value.
But then these same owners apply for the Mills Act. How does the Mills Act stack on top of an already frozen property value?
So it acts as an invisible first layer. The Mills Act substitutes a new, highly restricted formula to determine the property's taxable value, completely bypassing the market value.
How does the new formula work?
Instead of looking at what the house would sell for, the Mills Act assesses the property based on its potential to generate rental income, minus the heavy costs of historic maintenance.
Wow.
Yeah. When you apply that restrictive formula to an assessed value that has already been artificially suppressed by Prop 13 for decades, I mean, the floor just drops out entirely.
The double discount.
Exactly. The double discount. The researchers looked at the data and found 120 contracts where the property's final tax value is actually below 30% of what their already discounted Prop 13 floor would be.
That's insane.
The Mills Act is doing massive abatement work for these specific owners. And unsurprisingly, 82 of those 120 properties are located in what the report categorizes as low barriers to wealth neighborhoods.
The wealthiest enclaves in the city.
Yep.
I want to highlight a specific example from the text because it is just staggering. Imagine a single $10 million estate in Bel Air.
Okay.
Under the stacked Mills Act formula, that single property saves approximately $56,000 a year in property taxes. When the researchers calculate that out over 30 years, factoring in property appreciation, that single estate represents roughly $3.7 million in foregone public revenue.
It's hard to even fathom. And to ground that number, $3.7 million is enough to pay a public school teacher's salary for 15 years.
Wow.
That is the civic cost of subsidizing one luxury house.
And just when you think you've seen the bottom of this loophole, the report introduces the new buyer windfall. What happens when that Bel Air estate is eventually sold to someone else?
Well, by law, these Mills Act contracts run with the land, not the owner.
Yeah.
So when a property is sold, the new buyer automatically inherits the massive tax abatement.
Wait, let me make sure I have this straight. The new buyer doesn't have to prove that they are facing a financial hardship to maintain the historic property.
Nope.
They don't have to prove they are opening the house to the public.
They don't have to prove anything. They inherit the multi-decade tax abatement that was designed, negotiated, and approved for someone else entirely.
That is mind-blowing.
I know. The buyer pays the current astronomical market rate to acquire the house, proving they have massive capital, but their property taxes are instantly slashed because of a contract they had absolutely nothing to do with.
It's like someone acquiring a massive VIP lifetime discount code at a luxury store, and then when they decide to leave, they just hand that code to a stranger in the parking lot so that stranger can use it forever.
That's a perfect analogy.
Meanwhile, everyone else in the store is paying full retail price.
Exactly. And the numbers back up how prevalent this is. The report cross-referenced the contracts against the LA County Assessor's current parcel roll.
What did they find?
They found that 42.4% of these contracts are now held by post-transfer owners, meaning almost half of the people receiving this subsidy today simply inherited it when they bought the building.
So financially, that translates to 66.1% of the total Mills Act savings. That's $13.3 million annually flowing to inheritors, not original applicants.
Yep.
There's actually one commercial property listed in the report, a building on South Broadway, where the contract was signed in 2005. The property was sold to a new commercial buyer in 2011. That new owner is now saving an estimated $930,000 every single year in taxes without ever having applied for the original program.
It completely detaches the subsidy from the policy's original intent.
Total.
If the stated goal is to help a middle-class owner afford the expensive, specialized upkeep of a genuinely historic craftsman home, giving $1 million annual tax break to a commercial buyer who just acquired a massive property makes zero economic sense for the city.
So we have a system designed for public benefit that has been captured by a Nash equilibrium, supercharged by Prop 13 stacking, and perpetuated by the new buyer windfall.
It's a mess.
It really is. So how do you untangle a trap this perfectly set? I mean, if you just cancel the program entirely, you might actually lose some genuinely important buildings. Does the report offer a way to fix this without destroying LA's history?
It does, actually. The genius of the proposed reforms is that they don't recommend canceling preservation at all. They recommend attacking the underlying game theory.
Disrupting the game.
Right. They disrupt the incentives that keep the system locked in its socially inefficient state. The report offers a five-part blueprint, starting with a really simple concept, an income cap.
Okay, so how does that protect the regular people who actually need the help?
By capping the annual tax savings, any single agreement can generate at $15,000. And phasing out benefits entirely for properties with an assessed value over $2 million.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, it keeps the program alive for the middle-class owner in Highland Park, who genuinely needs financial help replacing a historic slate roof, but cuts off the public subsidy for the $10 million Bel Air estate that doesn't need the city's help to survive.
That removes the largest margin properties from the equation entirely. But what about the unfalsifiable tourism claim? How do you prove a building is actually benefiting the public?
That leads to the second reform, public benefit certification. If you are receiving a public subsidy, you have to prove a public benefit every single year to renew it.
What does that look like in practice?
The property owner would have to demonstrate actual public access, perhaps by legally opening the house to the public for, say, 12 days a year, or prove they have an active cultural tenancy or educational programming on site.
Okay, so pure private residences with zero public engagement sitting behind giant gates would categorically lose the subsidy, regardless of how historically significant their architecture is.
Precisely.
But wait, stripping the subsidy doesn't solve the problem of these massive estates or commercial blocks just sitting there, taking up space in the middle of a housing crisis. The report notes there are at least 97 monuments sitting on premium land that are essentially blocking urban redevelopment.
Right. They're frozen in time.
So let me play devil's advocate here. If we force them to build housing over these historic sites, aren't we just bulldozing LA's actual history for luxury condos?
And that's where the third reform, adaptive reuse, comes in. The city would offer a new pathway. The owner is allowed to redevelop the property, perhaps building a six-story mixed-use housing complex on the land if they retain the historic street facade and key structural elements.
So they compromise.
Exactly. They lose the perpetual tax subsidy, but they gain the legal right to build and profit from new housing. It converts static, subsidized outdoor museum pieces into economically productive buildings that generate full property taxes, sales taxes, and desperately needed housing, all while preserving the visual character of the street.
But what if the owner of a historic site just, you know, doesn't want to become an apartment landlord? What if they just want to keep their historic building exactly as it is, but the city desperately needs that zoning space for density?
For that scenario, the report introduces the fourth reform, transfer of development rights, or TDR. This is a pure market solution.
How does that work?
Well, in zoning terms, development rights dictate how big or tall a building you are legally allowed to put on a piece of land. The city would allow the historic property owner to calculate the unused development potential of their land, the difference between the small historic building currently sitting there and the massive apartment block the zoning code technically allows.
And since they can't build the apartment block without destroying the historic building, those rights are just sitting there useless.
Exactly. But under TDR, the owner can sever those unused air rights from their property and sell them on the open market to a developer in another part of the city. Yeah. The developer buys those rights to build a taller building in a zone that can handle the density, and the historic property owner gets a massive one-time cash payout from the developer.
That's absolutely brilliant. The historic owner is financially compensated for preserving the building, but the compensation comes from a private market transaction, not a perpetual public tax subsidy. And the city gets to keep collecting full property taxes on both sites.
It's a win for the city's budget, a win for housing density, and a win for true preservation.
Okay, so what's the fifth reform?
The final reform brings all of this together by instituting a 15-year sunset. All designations, existing and new, would automatically expire after 15 years.
Hard deadline.
Yep. To keep the designation and the tax break, the property must pass a rigorous economic impact review. Does it draw tourism? Is it accessible? What is the opportunity cost to the city in lost housing by keeping this site frozen?
If we look back at the game theory board we talked about earlier, these reforms completely dismantle the professional intermediary class. Automatic means testing and a 15-year sunset reduce the population of properties that even qualify for the program.
Significantly.
The overall opportunity for consultants to extract massive fees shrinks dramatically because you only hire a specialist if you have a viable, verifiable case for public benefit.
Exactly. It breaks the ratchet.
So what does this all mean for you listening at home? It is a powerful reminder that good intentions in public policy are simply not enough. You can design a program with the noble goal of protecting cultural history, but when that system becomes overly complex, it will inevitably get captured.
It always does.
It gets captured by those who have the resources to hire the navigators and the gatekeepers. True urban preservation shouldn't require starving a city's schools and parks to subsidize private estates.
Absolutely. And, you know, the researchers left a fascinating breadcrumb in the methodology section at the very end of the report regarding how this capture might finally be broken.
What did they say?
They point out that all of this information, every owner's name, every mailing address, every currently assessed property value, and the exact dollar amount of the subsidy is public record.
Wait, really? It's all public?
It's all sitting right now in the LA County Assessor's public database, just waiting to be cross-referenced. Right now, the Nash equilibrium holds because the $505 million cost is diffuse. It's an invisible $2 or $3 a year for the average taxpayer.
Right.
But imagine what would happen if someone built a simple public website, a website that mapped every single one of these invisible subsidies right down to the specific multi-million dollar mansions in your neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
If that diffused $3 cost suddenly had a wealthy face and a specific residential address attached to it, would the political calculus change? Would the Nash equilibrium finally break?
That is quite the thought experiment. Something for you to consider the next time you're driving through LA and you look out your window at one of those perfectly preserved, entirely sealed off, historic private estates. That's our deep dive for today. Keep questioning the systems around you.